As I was preparing my remarks for this meeting, studying some of the legal briefs in the litigation and the transcript of the oral arguments before the Supreme Court last December, I became convinced that there has been a major and a fatal philosophical mistake made by those who call themselves creationists. For that reason, I'm adding a subtitle to my talk, The Hoax of Scientific Creationism. 3 years ago, I had the opportunity to speak at the annual convention of the Baltimore Creation Fellowship on the subject of the political impact of scientific creationism. At that time, I pointed out that the political impact has been confined almost wholly in the field of education, since the educational system of this country is largely controlled by the government. I believe that the Baltimore Creation Fellowship still has cassette tapes of my 84 talk, as well as my 1985 and 1986 talks, and those interested in this subject might want to get those tapes after listening to my remarks today. I also have available the text of one of these talks entitled The Scientist as Evangelist. They're out there on the book table, as Richard mentioned. Feel free to pick them up if you would like. These talks are all part of a systematic approach to science that I hope you will acquaint yourself with. A more detailed statement of this approach is given in Gordon H. Clark's book, The Philosophy of Science and Belief in God, which is available for purchase today, also outside on the table. 3 years ago at this convention, I predicted that the scientific creationists would lose the Louisiana case, and they did so, resulting in their appeal to the Supreme Court. Since the court has not yet handed down a decision in this case, and a decision is expected at any moment, I shall hazard another prediction. The scientific creationists will lose again. But I would like to go further and make another comment. Not only will they lose, they deserve to lose. In 1981, the legislature of the state of Louisiana enacted the Balanced Treatment for Creation Science and Evolution Science Act by overwhelming majorities. 79% of the House and 68% of the Senate supported the bill. A challenge to the constitutionality of that act has reached the United States Supreme Court. It is my purpose here to discuss the philosophical, not the legal, arguments advanced by the defenders of scientific creationism. I do not intend to discuss the various steps in the extensive litigation surrounding this act, but to call attention to the argument put forth by the scientific creationists, an argument that is hostile to Christianity. It is not merely the state of Louisiana that advances this anti-Christian line of thought. The counsel of record in the case is Wendell Byrd, who has gained fame in recent years for his activities defending scientific creationism and who presented the oral argument before the Supreme Court last December. In addition to Mr. Byrd, several men formed a nonprofit tax-exempt organization to raise money for the prosecution of this litigation, and that organization carries on its letterhead the names of some of the leading lights of creationism in the United States: Henry Morris, A.E. Wilder Smith, George Howe, Walter Lemaertz, John Klotz, Duane Gish, Bolton David Iser, James Robison, Tim LaHaye, George Benson, John Whitehead, Howard Phillips, and Gary North. The appearance of these names and the association of these men with this litigation are quite surprising when one reads the legal briefs and the transcript of the oral arguments before the Supreme Court. For the briefs, contrary to what you and the American people have been led to believe, do not represent Christianity and are, in fact, hostile to Christianity. In a few moments, I shall quote the briefs filed in the Louisiana case. After I have done so, I believe that you will agree that the views represented in the briefs are not Christian and do not deserve the support of those who claim to be Christian. Let me begin with the issue of academic freedom. The Louisiana statute declares that the act is, quote, enacted for the purpose of protecting academic freedom, unquote. Unfortunately, the act does not define the phrase academic freedom, even though it does define several other terms. In their briefs, the scientific creationists seize upon this undefined phrase and try to infuse their own meaning. They argue that the purpose of the act is to protect the students' academic freedom, quote, to hear additional scientific information, unquote. But that, of course, is not the meaning of the phrase academic freedom. The lawyer opposing the scientific creationists argued before the Supreme Court that, quote, the idea of academic freedom that is advanced here is unlike any previous notion of that term. It's not a term, it's an incantation, as Mr. Byrd uses it. The Federal Appeals Court had come to the same conclusion, and in its decision it stated, academic freedom embodies the principle that individual instructors are at liberty to teach that which they deem appropriate in the exercise of their professional judgment. The principle of academic freedom abjures state interference with curriculum or theory as antithetical to the search for truth. The Balanced Treatment Act is contrary to the very concept it avows. The compulsion inherent in the Balanced Treatment Act is, on its face, inconsistent with the idea of academic freedom as it is universally understood, unquote. Let me make clear, very clear, what is happening here, for it is typical of the whole argument. The scientific creationists are attempting to change the meaning of words in order to achieve the goal that they want. They have attempted to redefine academic freedom, and that is not the only nor the most important term they misuse. An effort that requires this sort of intellectual dishonesty cannot advance truth. The Federal Appeals Court recognized the deception involved in this maneuver, and they pointed it out in their opinion. Yet the American people, and especially American Christians, have not been so perspicacious as the federal court. They have been fooled by the scientific creationists, who rely on American Christians for their funding. The American people, particularly American Christians, have been fooled by the word creation. They tend to think that all people who use the word creation are talking about the same thing, namely the biblical account of creation. But they are not. All the people who use the word God or the phrase born again are not using those terms in the sense that the Bible uses them. Shirley MacLaine means something quite different when she uses the phrase born again. The scientific creationists have made it crystal clear for all who care to read what they have written that they are not talking about the Genesis account of creation, which is the only account that all Christians hold to be true. The scientific creationist notion of creation is as different from the biblical doctrine of creation as the reincarnationist notion of the new birth is different from the biblical's teaching about regeneration. Let me quote some more from their legal briefs. The briefs open with this assertion, quote, creation science consists of scientific evidence and not religious concepts, unquote. Any Christian worth his salt should prick up his ears at such a statement. If he does, he will not be disappointed. On the same page, the brief states that, quote, creation science does not necessitate reference to a creator or God, unquote. Let me repeat that. Creation science does not necessitate reference to a creator or God. That statement, as well as the first, is on the first page of the brief. Moreover, both these statements are repeated throughout the briefs many times. They are not simply slips of the pen or typewriter. They are essential parts of the scientific creationist arguments. On page 6 of the brief, we find this statement, quote, there are several misconceptions about creation science. It does not, and the emphasis is in the original, it does not essentially involve creation from nothing, kinds of plants or animals, catastrophism or a worldwide flood, or a relatively recent inception of the universe and life, unquote. Let me read the statement again. There are several misconceptions about creation science. It does not essentially involve creation from nothing, kinds of plants or animals, catastrophism or a worldwide flood, or a relatively recent inception of the universe and life, unquote. Being a Christian, I thought creationism essentially involved most, if not all, of those things. Biblical creationism certainly does, but scientific creationism does not. The scientific creationists say so themselves. Is it not obvious that the scientific creationists are trying to redefine the term creation, just as they tried to redefine the phrase academic freedom, in order to bamboozle both the courts and the Christians? Please do not assume, as most people seem to do, that people always use words in their normal or usual sense. They don't, especially when they have a hidden motive or are governed by fear. The litigation is a prime example of the deliberate misuse of words. On the same page on which these statements appear, we find the scientific creationist definition of creation, and I quote, "Creation science means origin through abrupt appearance in complex form of biological life, life itself, and the physical universe. Creation in this context means simply abrupt appearance in complex form." I repeat that definition. Creation means simply, quote, "abrupt appearance in complex form," unquote. Let me ask you gentlemen here today, is that what you mean by creation? Is this the Baltimore Abrupt Appearance in Complex Form Society? Or is this the Baltimore Creation Fellowship? The lawyer opposing the scientific creationists, who in all likelihood is a secular humanist, commented about this novel definition of the word creation. "It has never before been seen upon the face of the earth, except in Mr. Bird's briefs and in the affidavits prepared by the scientific creationists." In his oral argument before the Supreme Court, he quoted Webster's Third International Dictionary, published in 1981, on the word creation, quote, "the act of bringing into existence, from nothing, the universe or the world or the living and non-living things in it." He also quoted Webster's second edition, published in 1934, "the act of creating or the fact of being created, specifically the act of causing to exist or the fact of being brought into existence by divine power or its equivalent," unquote. As a Christian, I would prefer to agree with other Christians rather than with secular humanists. I'm sure that you would too. But that understandable prejudice should never prevent us from perceiving that in this case, and in many other cases, the secular humanist is closer to the truth than those who profess to be Christians. He knows what creation means, and he knows the scientific creationists are trying to deny it. As a Christian, one can be only embarrassed by such subreption. As you know, the abrupt appearance of complex forms does not necessarily involve creation at all. Stephen Jay Gould of Harvard University has developed a theory of punctuated equilibrium that is compatible with the abrupt appearance of complex forms. Gould is a militant anti-Christian. But since his views fit the definition of creation offered by the scientific creationists, we must conclude that Stephen Jay Gould is a creationist. Fred Hoyle, a non-Christian, and N. Rick Mamasinghe, a Hindu, also support the abrupt appearance of complex forms by imagining evolution from outer space. That makes them creationists as well. Other theories of hopeful monsters, massively mutated life forms, are equally compatible with the abrupt appearance of complex forms. These theories are evolutionist, not creationist, but they all miraculously become creationist by virtue of this startling new definition of the word creation. It is now possible for agnostics, atheists, Hindus, and evolutionists to be classified as creationists, for they all may believe in the abrupt appearance of complex forms. The scientific creationist brief, of course, does not let the matter rest by stating this novel and perverse definition of creation only once. It repeats it several times. This repetition is itself important, for it underscores the fact that this new and non-Christian view of creation is central to the scientific creationist argument. One of the scientific creationist witnesses, Dr. Terry L. Meathey, a professor at Liberty University in Lynchburg, Virginia, filed an affidavit in which he said, quote, "Creation science has changed in content over the past decade and is different from the religious views of creation that prevailed over the past centuries. Now, this is a most important statement. Creation science has changed its meaning over the past decade. It is different from the religious views of creation that have prevailed in past centuries. Since the religious views of creation that have prevailed in past centuries, at least in the United States and Europe, are the biblical view, creation science is not Christian. The difference between scientific creationism and Christianity and the hostility of the scientific creationists to Christianity may be seen in another quotation from their brief. Quote, "The state," which was the side that the scientific creationists were on, "the state agrees wholeheartedly that public schools constitutionally may not and should not teach the Genesis account of creation in science classes. The Louisiana legislator who sponsored the Balanced Treatment Act and who heads the Creation Science Legal Defense Fund, Bill Keith, is quoted in the brief as saying, quote, "I have been accused of wanting to teach the first chapter of Genesis in our science classrooms in the public schools. Not only would I be opposed to that, I have never advocated that," unquote. In his oral argument before the Supreme Court, Wendell Byrd, representing the state of Louisiana, said, quote, "The state agrees wholeheartedly that the teaching of the Bible as part of implementing this statute would be unconstitutional. The state has consistently taken the position that that, in a science classroom, would not be appropriate under the Constitution or under the statute." Mr. Byrd repeated that statement several times before the Supreme Court last December. Consider also this colloquy between Mr. Byrd and a justice of the Supreme Court. The justice asked, "Does it, creation science, necessarily require the teaching of a God, a personal God, as opposed to a first cause that may be quite impersonal, or a giant slug, for all we know?" Mr. Byrd replied, "Your Honor, teaching creation science does not entail necessarily the teaching of any of those concepts. In other words, with creation science consisting of scientific evidence, in none of that is there any concept of a creator, and certainly no concept of Genesis," unquote. Could any further statements be clearer than these? The Balanced Treatment Act, the state of Louisiana, the Creation Science Legal Defense Fund, Wendell Byrd, and by implication, all the men who have permitted their names to be used by that organization are advocating a theory of creation quite different from the biblical doctrine. Moreover, they are all opposed to teaching the Genesis account of creation in science classes. Perhaps they would allow the Genesis account to be taught in literature classes, along with Greek and Roman mythology, but certainly not in science classes, where the subject is truth. Let me review this astonishing and scandalous situation. There is a case before the Supreme Court of the United States involving many professed Christian leaders. In the public's mind, the case involves the Christian doctrine of creation and whether or not it can be taught in the government schools of Louisiana. But if one reads the briefs prepared by the scientific creationists in this litigation, and one does not even have to read them very closely, it is abundantly clear that the constitutionality of the biblical doctrine of creation being taught in the public schools is not being litigated, that all the parties agree that it must not be allowed in science classes in the government schools, and that the public, especially the Christians of America who blindly trust their leaders to tell them the truth, have been conned into supporting a movement that is non-Christian by its own repeated admission. How did this happen? How did the change in content and the meaning of creation occur in the last decade? How have the Christians of America been fooled? The full explanation is a study in the failure of evidentialist apologetics. Since many people, including some scientists, are discouraged by the use of any theological word having more than two syllables, I will define apologetics as the science of defending the faith. That should please those scientists who disdain anything non-scientific. I will also define faith as the propositions contained in the Bible, together with all their logical implications. The Bible is a system of truth, and it is the purpose of apologetics to defend the truth against all who would deny it. Given these definitions, we can see that apologetics is not concerned with defending common sense notions or scientific opinions. It is concerned with defending the Bible. The modern creationist movement began about 25 years ago with the publication of The Genesis Flood by Henry M. Morris and John C. Whitcomb. The book was designed to defend the Genesis account of Noah's flood as a worldwide flood. Moreover, it was designed to do so by citing evidence from geology, hydrology, and other scientific disciplines that is compatible with the Genesis account and difficult to explain on the basis of uniformitarian evolutionary theory. The Genesis flood was an interesting attempt to embarrass those scientists who denied catastrophism by marshaling the evidence that seemed to imply a worldwide catastrophe like the Genesis flood. But Messrs. Morris and Whitcomb never quite got the logical situation straight. They have never quite understood what proves what. And if this failure is disastrous in high school geometry, it is absolutely fatal in theology. Morris's and Whitcomb's method seemed to imply that scientific evidence could prove the truth of Genesis. But at least Morris and Whitcomb kept fairly close to the scriptures and were concerned to defend the accuracy of the biblical statements. Unfortunately, their very concern with scripture is what obscured the irreparable flaws in their apologetic method. In the past 10 years, we have seen that incorrect method carried to its logical conclusion. That conclusion has been the transformation of biblical creationism into scientific creationism. As the quotations from the scientific creationists that I have already read demonstrate, Morris's and Whitcomb's early fidelity to the scriptures has been jettisoned by the implications of their apologetic method, as the implications of their apologetic method have become more and more clear. The scientific creationists have declared their independence from the Bible. Scientific creationism does not necessarily involve religious concepts, a creator or God, creation from nothing, catastrophism, a worldwide flood, and the recent inception of life or kinds of plants or animals. Science is capable of discovering truth, according to these men. One need not start with the Bible at all. This is one of the most prevalent superstitions of the 20th century. The development of the sort of non-scriptural, even anti-scriptural, scientific creationism that we have been discussing is a logically inevitable result of the belief that science is not a handmaiden to theology, but an independent enterprise that can prove some vague notion of creation. It cannot. Science cannot prove anything, let alone prove creation. But it is this blind faith in science as a cognitive enterprise that explains why the meaning of creation has changed in the last 10 years and is now quite different from the religious views of past centuries. The non-Christian idea is being defended in this litigation, and the method used in their defense may be illustrated by the religious backgrounds and education of the expert witnesses called by the scientific creationists. These witnesses exemplify the fatally flawed nature of scientific creationism and its method of apologetics. The scientific creationists have relied on Hindus like Wick Ramasinghe, agnostics, atheists, and Thomists like Norman Geisler and Terry Neitha. They have not called one expert witness who believes that it is both impious and just plain stupid to try to prove from science that the Word of God is true. In the Louisiana case, none of the expert witnesses called by the scientific creationist represent a biblical point of view. 3 expert witnesses in philosophy, theology, and education were called. Dr. Terry Neitha earned his first doctorate from St. Louis University, a Roman Catholic institution. His Master of Divinity degree came from McCormick Seminary in Chicago, which he himself describes in a sworn affidavit as theologically liberal and neo-orthodox. He is a member of the National Jesuit Honor Society, Alpha Sigma Nu. He is also a professor at Liberty University, a fundamentalist institution. The fact that a faculty member of a Christian institution can be a graduate of a liberal and neo-orthodox seminary and a member of the Jesuit Honor Society should set off alarm bells in the head of anyone concerned about guarding Christ's doctrine. The expert witness in theology was the Reverend Dr. William G. Most. Dr. Most earned his bachelor's, master's, and doctor's degrees from Roman Catholic institutions, the two advanced degrees from Catholic University. He is a former president of the Mariological Society of America, a member of the Pontifical International Marian Academy, and the author of Mary and Our Life, among many other books and articles. In his affidavit for the scientific creationist, Dr. Most stated that, quote, "I am personally wide open on the question of evolution from a religious point of view. I believe that the answer must come from science," unquote. The expert witness in education was Dr. Robert Klinkert, also a Roman Catholic who earned his doctorate from Loyola University in Chicago. The selection of these men to defend Christianity would be inexcusable, but we have already seen that what they are defending is not Christianity, but something called scientific creationism. These men are advocating something, but it is not Christianity. Yet Christians have been bamboozled into supporting scientific creationism by giving hundreds of thousands of dollars to fund this litigation and similar lawsuits all across the country. In a century of religious and scientific hoaxes, scientific creationism may be among the biggest. But rather than simply understanding that scientific creationism is not Christian and does not deserve the support of Christians, it is far more important that we understand how biblical creationism was transformed into scientific creationism in the space of 10 years. That shift, so subtle and yet so rapid, illustrates the enormous danger and futility of trying to fight divine battles with human weapons. The emergence of scientific creationism from biblical creationism in the last decade is due to the use and popularity of evidentialist apologetics, an unscriptural philosophy. The sort of vain philosophy that we are warned about in Colossians is the cause of the change. There are two basic forms of Christian apologetics, evidentialism and presuppositionalism. The evidentialist form holds that Christians ought to try to prove the existence of God and the veracity of the Bible on the basis of premises that all men will accept, such as the reliability of sense perception. The presuppositionalist method holds that the existence of God and the inerrancy of Scripture are to be assumed as indemonstrable axioms. They cannot be proved, and it is both impious and stupid to try. Involved in the evidentialist method, although the evidentialist may be reluctant to admit it, is the necessity of redefining key terms. We have seen how the scientific creationists have attempted to redefine academic freedom and creation, emptying the latter of almost all biblical. But this redefinition of terms may also be clearly seen in the best evidentialist apologete of them all, the 13th century Roman Catholic Thomas Aquinas. Thomas held that one could prove the existence of God in five ways, and the first and more manifest way was the way of motion. Quote, "It is certain and evident to our senses," Thomas wrote, "that in the world some things are in motion," unquote. From this axiom, that he considered indubitable, Thomas attempted to deduce an unmoved mover. He concluded his proof by saying, quote, "And this everyone understands to be God," unquote. But Thomas's unmoved mover is the unmoved mover of the pagan Aristotle. It is no more the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. It is no more Jesus Christ than scientific creationism is the Genesis account of creation. Writing in Latin, Thomas referred to his unmoved mover and his first cause as neuters. They are it. God is not a neuter. God is not an it. The reason that both philosophical giants like Thomas Aquinas and the modern-day scientific creationists must redefine their terms is their common method of apologetics, evidentialism. One cannot deduce the God of the Bible from any secular axioms, whether these axioms be common sense, scientific evidence, or simply sense perception. It is logically impossible. One of the first rules of logic is that terms must not appear in the conclusion of an argument that did not first appear in its premises. If the terms are not in the premises, they logically cannot show up in the conclusion. Even Thomas Aquinas admitted that he believed in creation only because it was revealed by God. But the scientific creationists are not quite so wise as Thomas.
Appear to succeed, to make it appear plausible, Evidentialism substitutes something for both God and for creation. They cannot logically get to God from their premises, and they cannot get to creation either. For that reason, Thomas Aquinas substituted Aristotle's unmoved mover for God, and scientific creationists substitute the abrupt appearance of complex forms for creation. Then they assert, they do not prove, they assert that Aristotle's unmoved mover is the same as God, and the abrupt appearance of complex forms is the same as creation. Neither proposition is true. The influence of evidentialist apologetics on scientific creationism may be seen by reading any of the relevant books. It may also be seen in the Louisiana statute itself, for the statute repeatedly uses the word evidences. I quote from the statute, "Creation science means the scientific evidences for creation and inferences from those scientific evidences. Evolution science means the scientific evidences for evolution and inferences from those scientific evidences," unquote. Only evidentialist apologetes talk like this. Everyone else uses the word evidence in the singular. The Louisiana statute was drafted by someone steeped in the murky brew of evidentialism. The author left his unmistakable mark in all the S's in the law. The scientific creationists have furnished us with their own statements distinguishing their views from those of the Bible. It is past time for biblical Christians to consider whether they ought to continue to spend thousands of dollars on such specious arguments, and, more importantly, whether Christians can any longer afford to use a method of defending the faith that inexorably leads to non-Christian conclusions. It has taken only a decade for biblical creationism to turn into scientific creationism. Many Christians are not yet aware of the change. The scientific creationists have a pecuniary interest in keeping them uninformed of the change. But the ramifications of the change are extensive, and its implications are lethal. Once the axiomatic acceptance of Scripture as inerrant is abandoned, the surrender to paganism is sure and swift. The Bible and the Bible alone is the source of truth.
It is in the Bible alone that we read about creationism. Neither science nor Aristotle has anything to say about it. Science is ever learning and never able to come to the knowledge of truth. Let us therefore, as biblical creationists, stop funding and supporting the scientific creationists and return to our divinely commanded duty of building Christian schools, publishing Christian books, and preaching the whole counsel of God to every creature. And let those who call themselves Christians return to the faith they profess and defend it as it ought to be defended, as God's truth, and nothing less. Thank you.
Do you want to make some questions?
Sure.
I have one.
Yes, sir.
Say if you were in, if you personally were in charge, you might say, of the science curriculum in, say, a public school system, would you kind of have your view of your bringing out the definition, the official definition, might say, of academic freedom? What would you do in regard to the teaching of Mormons, say, in the biology class? Would you exercise any control? How would you deal with that?
Well, the question is complicated by several factors, and I'm going to answer your question. Don't think I'm evading it. But I'm convinced that the scientific creationists, Christians generally, in trying to get a balanced treatment for something they call creation, have made a significant error, because the public school system should be challenged at its root, not in the curriculum. We should be challenging the idea that the school or the government has the right to compel people to listen to any doctrine and to collect tax money to support teachers of any doctrine. 200 years ago, we had established churches in this country. The teachers were paid from tax money. People were compelled to attend the meetings. And the same thing happens with public schools now. The public schools are the established church of the 20th century. And rather than trying to force something called creation science into the curriculum, we ought to be challenging the idea that any man ought to be forced to listen to any doctrine or to pay for any doctrine that he disagrees with. That's the principle on which the churches were disestablished, and it's also the principle on which the public schools must be disestablished. But to answer your question directly, first, I hope I wouldn't be in that position. Secondly, if I were in that position, with my views of academic freedom, the only thing I could do would be to hire teachers that would reflect my view of Genesis and science, and then let them teach what they want to teach in their professional judgment.
So you would think it would be appropriate then to teach the Genesis record of creation in the science curriculum?
Certainly. Certainly.
And authoritative.
Yes. Yes. Now, that can't be done today. If a teacher tries it, he will be thrown out of his job. I wish the teachers would try it, though. I wish the public school teachers who profess to be Christians would teach Christianity in the schools and be thrown out of their jobs. Then we could see exactly what sort of institution we're dealing with. We're dealing with an established church that will not tolerate dissent, that collects tax money to pay its teachers, compels students to attend the lectures. This is exactly the sort of institution that we abolished in this country 200 years ago. Yes, sir.
I have a couple of questions. In presenting your paper, you have used some rather highly emotional and derogatory terms relating to scientific creations. If I recall correctly, you have used the term impious, stupid, dishonest. I wonder if it is possible to hold your position without using that type of rhetoric.
Oh, certainly it is. Those terms were applied to the arguments. I said it is impious to try to prove that the word of God is true from scientific evidence. That was my sentence in the book, in the paper.
In the context that you used the word stupid.
It is stupid to try to prove that the Bible is true from scientific evidence.
Well,
one who attempts that simply doesn't know what proves what.
I guess my question is if it is possible in the context of a meeting like this to disagree with people without using highly derogatory terms and emotionally laden terms. Why aren't we doing that?
Precisely because of the con job. I'll use another one that has been going on. Do you disagree, sir, that in the public mind, including the minds of most American Christians, the battle in the courts, and particularly in Louisiana, is between the biblical view of creation and the evolutionary hypothesis? Is that the popular belief about what's going on? It certainly is, isn't it? Why aren't these scientific creationists telling us that they don't want anything to do with the Bible? Why do I have to get up and point that out? Because it would destroy their fundraising. If they were to go before the American people, particularly American Christians, and say, look, this has nothing to do with the Bible. Everybody agrees we don't want the Genesis account taught in the schools, in the science classes. As I say, maybe they'll allow it in the literature classes. But there is a great deal of deception going on here, sir. And if I point that out in strong terms, it's only because I think it needs to be pointed out in strong terms.
Let me say, first of all, I don't believe that all scientific creations are comfortable with these legal cases.
I'm glad to hear that. Let's hear from them.
You're unaware of that, sir?
Well, let's hear from them.
Well, okay, maybe I'm using the wrong term here. I would like to give you a little bit about my position, and I would like you to tell me whether you consider me a scientific creationist or a biblical creationist, because maybe we're using terms in different ways.
Okay, just define creation.
Well, I'm not going to define creation. I'm going to tell you how I view things, and I want you to tell me whether I'm a scientific creationist or a biblical creationist, okay? I'm a biologist. I'm an earned doctor from the University of Iowa in zoology. At the time that I was a graduate student, I faced the whole problem of evolution day after day for 5 years. During that time, I seriously questioned the biblical account of creation. Okay, how we want to define creation, at least a normal reading of the Genesis account. After finishing graduate school, I had sufficient time to go back and re-evaluate both my theological position and my scientific position. At the present time, I view the following. First of all, I believe that the Bible teaches a recent creation. I believe that the Bible teaches creation within specific, though rather undefined, we may not know exactly what the Genesis kinds are, but there are limited variations in organisms. Now, I also believe that scientifically, as a scientist, I have a responsibility to my profession to study science as I understand it, and to try to come to some understanding of origins from a scientific perspective. In the science that I have studied, both in the field, in the laboratory, and in textbooks, I find no evidence that demands an ancient Earth or anything other than rather limited variation. Am I a scientific creationist? Am I a biblical creationist? Am I a neither? Am I a fish? Am I a fowl? I don't understand how you would term it, how you would view me at this particular point.
Well, how I view you, sir, is immaterial. I would point out that you...
Well, no, it's very material because I have to understand what your terms that you use.
Well, I pointed out the definition of creation that the scientific creationists in their litigation are using. I also pointed out the list of gentlemen who are the leading lights of scientific creation in this country that have lent their name to this litigation. That definition of creation does not include two elements that you've just mentioned as what you believe. One of those elements was a recent creation of the earth, and the other was kinds. They may be undefined at this point, but there are limits to changes. The scientific creationists, in their legal briefs, denied both of those things. They denied the recent inception of the earth. They denied catastrophism. They denied a creator. They denied a god. They denied kinds. They denied a worldwide flood. All the essential elements of creation that are found in the Bible, they say do not belong to the term creation. Now, if you'd like, you know, I can write their definitions on the board so they stay here all day long. So you can see exactly what they're talking about. But you, sir, do not fit their definition, because you have said that you believe in a recent creation and you believe in kinds.
You know, is that scientific creationism? Is that biblical creationism?
Well, I'd have to know. Do you believe in the other things the Bible teaches? Do you believe in God? Okay, then you believe in a creator or God. That's three things that you disagree with the scientific creationists on. Do you believe in catastrophism? Okay, that's four things. What were the other things? I've forgotten now. But I suspect if we went down the list, sir, you would find that you are a biblical creationist, not a scientific creationist. And that's what I'm presuming most of the people that are here today.
And yet, when I go into the laboratory,
yes,
I'm looking at the data scientifically. I'm trying to make observations. I'm trying to make repeated observations. I'm trying to integrate it with previous studies, both with evolutionists and creationists. It would seem to me that a person could be both. I guess I don't see that the two are mutually exclusive.
Well, let me read the definition again.
Well, no, I'm asking you.
We know what the definition is in that litigation. That's not necessarily what these men all believe.
Well, then that raises another question. If it's not what they believe, why are they supporting it?
I feel like, you know, in some contexts, when these kinds of meetings are held, it's only appropriate to direct questions to the speaker. But I would think this is one of the scientific-type sessions that it would be appropriate to exchange views as well as just seek a clarification of your understanding. Do you object to that?
No, certainly not.
It seems to me there's a key element to your argument that can be very confusing. I think the term scientific creationism and biblical creationism refer to categories of thought, do not refer to individuals. These individuals that you've mentioned, for the most part, are not scientific creationists, they're creationists. In other words, they believe the Bible is true. Anybody that knows Henry Morris, either through all of his writings or through him personally, would never suspect him of being anti-Christian, or deceptive, or anti-biblical, or any of that stuff, because it was just ludicrous on the face of it. But the point is that these are useful categories. You know, somebody says politics is hardly possible. And the point is that here are some people who think that students ought to get a balanced treatment. and that they don't believe that defendant presenting the Bible, like you said yourself, you know, that you can't teach the Bible now in the school. That's obviously not even a possibility. But these guys, in fact, Henry Morris wrote a little impact article where he separated biblical creation and scientific creation in a very useful way. These are categories. These are not individuals. These are not people. These are categories. These guys believe both in biblical creationism and scientific creationism. They're two different ways of looking at the subject of origin.
I disagree with none of that. I think that perhaps these men are as deceived as they are deceiving. Perhaps they really think that through the methods of science one can support biblical doctrines. If it's the case that they are as much deceived as deceiving, then that should be pointed out to them. Their methods cannot arrive at the conclusions they want to arrive at. And as long as they stick with those methods, they're going to be left defending some truncated definition of creation that has virtually nothing in common with what the Bible says about creation. Yes, sir?
I might give an example of, I think, what he just talked about, of categories rather than people. I teach a course in order in a Bible college. I tell my students when they come into that class, this is not a class on theology of origin. This is a class in science. And I use the book by Peter Bolting on Understanding and Evolution, which is a very fine little paperback written from an evolutionary standpoint. And we go through that book in detail and point out from a scientific standpoint the weaknesses of the theory of evolution. To me, at that point, I'm approaching it from standpoint of scientific creation. You probably wouldn't agree with that definition, but to me that's what it is. I'm looking at the evidence of science and saying, hey, the evidence of science to me supports limited variation. It supports origin in relatively recent time. It supports the idea that there is not a generic link between man and lower organisms. So at that point, we're approaching it from the standpoint of science. On the other hand, these same students, when they go into a theology class and study soteriology or any of the other doctrines, the doctrine of creation, they're approaching it from a biblical standpoint. I guess I don't see these two as mutually exclusive.
Well, I haven't said they're mutually exclusive. Let me repeat what I have said.
The transformation of one into the end.
I'm saying let me repeat what I have said then. I'll try to make it clearer. We are working with two different definitions of creation. One is the scientific creationist definition of creation. One is the biblical definition of creation. Now, if you went into your science class and you taught only that creation means abrupt appearance in complex form, then you could not use, I would guess, 3/4 of the scientific evidence that you do use in your science class. You are working from the framework of the biblical view of creation. And by citing evidences from biology, whatever, you are hoping to embarrass the evolutionists, which is good. They should be embarrassed. Cite all the evidence you want. They embarrass them to death. Silence them. But don't go on and make the further mistake that from the evidence that you cite, you can prove the Bible is true. You can't.
Would you say the same thing about archaeology?
Certainly.
You can't demonstrate from archaeology that Bible is true?
Of course not.
Can you come up with data that are consistent with a viewpoint that the Bible is true?
Yeah. But you cannot demonstrate.
I think that's the thing. A lot of that hinges on the words prove and demonstrate.
They're synonyms.
Yeah, well, that's what I'm saying. I'm not saying they're contrasting, but I mean, that's the key, I think, in maybe the confusion. I see those who are interested in the connection between creation and science as seeing that seem like their basic position is that what we observe through scientific approaches does not conflict, does support the biblical statements about creation. And it's the proof thing, I think, that makes it seem ludicrous, that the idea of, like, it's a mathematical proof or something.
Well, if someone does come up with scientific evidence that conflicts with the Bible, you can be sure the scientific evidence is wrong. It is scripture that confirms science, not the other way around.
Wait a minute. There's a difference between data and interpretation.
No, I disagree with that.
Well, sir, can I give an illustration?
Sure.
The classical scientific paper is given in most journals. It contains an introduction, a materials and methods section, introduction, materials and methods, results, and discussion. Okay? Mm-hmm. Anytime you put in a paper in which you confuse the results with the discussion, for most journals, the journal editors know the difference, and they'll kick it right back to you and say, this is not results, this is discussion. You keep the two separate. Okay, so the results and the discussion, or the results and the interpretation, are two entirely different categories. I can look at molecular data from hemoglobin, for instance, or amino acid sequencing from the liver proteins of two different organisms. Okay. And that data is the same kind of data that an evolutionist should get in his laboratory. In other words, when he redoes my experiment, he should get the same data. But we may come to entirely different conclusions based on our presuppositions as to what that means. So there is a very distinct difference between data and the interpretation of it. All scientists work with basically the same data. It's the interpretation of the data that is colored by a person's presupposition that's different.
Well, I agree with what you said about presuppositions. I would simply ask that you consider the question further. You might want to read the book that I mentioned earlier on the philosophy of science, because I think you'll see that in many sciences, people cannot even agree on what the facts are.
That is certainly true, but you don't make a distinction between the data and the interpretation of the data?
The facts are dependent upon the theory that precedes them. If I'm going to perform an experiment, I have to have a theory in mind before I even look for a specific fact. I select my facts on the basis of my preconceived theory. The theory comes first. It's not that there are facts sitting out there that I can go out and pick up one by one and put a theory together with. I have a theory first, then I go out and pick up my data. And I select the data.
Would you think then that an environmentalist on the one hand and an industrialist on the other hand, who are both concerned about acid rain, if they went out and took a pH meter and measured the pH of a specific lake, do you think that based on their one person who maybe wants to, is not uncomfortable with polluting the air and the other one is very concerned about it, are you saying that their pH meters would give you different values based on their theories?
I would say that not only would they give different values, they have. You have conflicting studies between industrialists and environmentalists.
That's the selection of data, not the data themselves. Like you said earlier, you know, that people mm-hmm. tend to reject data that don't go along with their preferences.
Mm-hmm.
This concludes Dr. Robbins' lecture entitled The Hoax of Scientific Creationism.